Everyone's experience is unique to them. This podcast contains the personal story, experience, and opinions of the speaker, rather than that of Breast Cancer Now. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. This is a series that shares the stories of people who have had breast cancer. It's also where you'll hear the voices of our nurses, researchers, and experts who help to provide support for today and hope for the future to anyone affected by breast cancer. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm Em, and today I'll be speaking with Liz O'Riordan. Liz is a former breast cancer surgeon and author who received her own diagnosis of breast cancer in 2015. We'll be talking about how her career affected her experience of being a patient and vice versa. Liz, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Em. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I think a good place to start off with, just to go into your history a little bit, would be to ask what initially drew you towards being a breast cancer surgeon. Was it something that you'd always wanted to do? Was it something you sort of figured out sort of further down in your career path?
That's a really interesting question. I think ever since I was a little girl, I knew I wanted to be a doctor and I was fascinated by surgery. My dad was a surgeon and I managed to get work experience in the sixth form and I just fell in love with the magic of what was going on in that table. And my problem was I loved every speciality I did because I was getting to do stuff. I loved orthopedics, then I loved A&E, then I loved general surgery. I loved everything. And when I first did breast surgery as a junior doctor, it was still very much mastectomy, wide local cut down over the lump. The reconstructive techniques hadn't been invented then. And I did it again towards the end of my training and I loved it. It had changed completely. Suddenly we were reconstructing breasts and hiding the scars and reshaping them. And it was like the most amazing artistry that I could do. But another huge factor, well, there were two actually. One was I like talking to people and I like having a relationship with my patients. And in most surgical specialities, you don't see them very often. But in breast surgery, there was quite a lot of follow-up, but there was also no encore. So most surgeons will do a normal working week, 8 to 6, Monday to Friday, and then they'll do nights and weekends on top of that. But there are no breast surgery emergencies. The patients tend not to die overnight. They're not on the ward. So it meant that I could have a life as well as being a surgeon. And because my husband is a consultant surgeon as well, if we were both on call, we'd never see each other. But for me, it was just that a woman can come in to see me with a large cancer in the breast and she walks out later that day with an invisible scar and you wouldn't know I'd operated on her. And it was just, I loved it. I just loved it.
Mm. I really like the way you talk about it as almost a form of art as well. I think
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So some of my general surgical colleagues don't understand what I can do for 4 hours when I'm just playing with fat and skin. It's like a weird dark art, but it is. And every patient is different because every breast is different. And you have to look at the quality of the skin and the size of the breast and how old they are and where the cancer is and work out what to do to redrape it. It's a bit like being a tailor or a dressmaker in a way.
Wow. Yeah, I've never heard it described in that way. But when you say a kind of dark art, that is almost morbidly fascinating. And I can imagine how every day would have been, just you getting to do your craft.
Yeah. And being able to gently tell women that they had breast cancer and look after them and guide them on that journey. It's incredibly emotional. And I didn't realize how hard it was going to be as a consultant, because as a trainee, you don't have any responsibility. But suddenly I was the one telling 10 women a day they had breast cancer and I was absorbing all their angry, negative, fear emotions and having to somehow deal with that and go home. And it was really, really hard. You don't get training, you don't get counseling to deal with it. And you want to give every patient you see the best of you. But sometimes it's really, really hard.
Yeah, I can imagine, but no, honestly, I can't imagine. It's something that, as we'll get onto, unless you have been on a certain side of it, it's not really something that you can get into. But how long had you been doing your job before you actually received your own diagnosis?
So I was a consultant surgeon in May 2013, which was 20 years when I first went to medical school in Cardiff. And in July 2015, so just over 2 years, I was diagnosed with breast cancer myself.
And I mean, obviously for anyone that's going to be, it's huge news, but for someone who, you've been a part of that world in one way or another for a significant part of your career. So how did you feel about receiving that news?
Well, I think I should go back to when I first found a breast lump, which was in 2008. and my husband had just proposed to me, and he'd gone off sailing around the Greenland and the Arctic for 8 weeks, and I found a lump, and I was in my late 30s, and my head went straight to, it's cancer, I'll lose my hair, I'll lose my breast, I'll be dead in a year, he won't want to marry me. And I can remember literally howling on the sofa with fear. And it sounds so histrionic at the time, but that was just that natural gut reaction of, shit, I found a lump, what could it be? Mm. And my boss knew there was something up the next day, and she managed to get me squeezed into the breast clinic, and it was just a cyst. It was always going to be a cyst. It looked like a cyst, it felt like a cyst, but my brain couldn't compute. And then in 2014, I had two lumps, one in each breast, that were both cysts again. And I'd had a normal mammogram, a normal ultrasound. And when I found another lump in my left breast, I just thought it was another cyst. I just saw it in my cleavage one day and I ignored it for a month because I wasn't worried, because I'd had a normal imaging 6 months before. And I told my mum, and she said, look, will you just get it checked out? Because I'm worried if you're not. So fine. So I went along, and I didn't go to the hospital where I worked at. I went to the hospital down the road where my husband works, just because I didn't want my own team knowing that I had a breast cyst. And the woman who saw me was actually the woman who trained me. And she was a friend and a mentor. And she had a look, and the mammogram was normal. And she said, well, I don't know what it is. We'll get an ultrasound. And I turned to look at the screen, because I do ultrasounds, and I saw a cancer. And whereas most women who are diagnosed are drip fed, you have a scan and then you have a biopsy and then you get the results and then you have surgery, and it would kind of drip feed you the information. In that split second, I knew I was young, it was big, I'd need a mastectomy, I was almost certainly going to have chemotherapy. I knew what my odds of being alive in 10 years were from that moment. And I got to go home and tell my mum that in 3 days' time, I'd be telling her I had cancer. They rushed the preliminary results through for me, which isn't normally done, and I'm incredibly grateful they did. But those 3 nights, most women wait at least a week, those 3 nights with the internet at my fingertips were horrific, because I used to tell patients not to Google, and it's crazy, it's the first thing you do. And I had no idea how hard it is to wait to find out whether it's cancer or not.
Yeah. And I mean, first of all, thank goodness for mums telling us what we know we should be doing. I'm really pleased you did have that extra just nudge in the right direction.
Oh God, me too.
And what you're saying about, you know, telling people not to Google, I've had so many conversations with people where they say, I know I shouldn't have Googled it.
Yeah.
It's obviously the first thing you do.
And I think as doctors, we should tell patients, you're going to go on your phone. So go to safe websites like Breast Cancer Now, the sensible, safe, trusted information that you can read and pass on to your relatives who don't know what's going on either. Because it's really hard as a patient. You're suddenly the doctor explaining to your husband or your brother or your mum, this is what they said. And you don't know anything about it.
Yeah, but I mean, in your situation, you did. Even without, you know, Dr. Google and going down all these sort of rabbit holes of things that you really don't want to be thinking about, there was obviously this weight of knowledge that you already had behind you. So how did you navigate that before anything was sort of certain?
It was really hot. I remember my surgeon coming in, looking at the screen, and she did the biopsy. And the last thing she said to me was, where do you want to be treated? Because we both knew it was a cancer. Mm. And my husband said, no, it'll be fine. Because that's all you can say, because you can't bear the thought, but think, no, it's not fine. You can't say that. You don't know that. And I had to decide how much information to give him and my parents, because they didn't need to know everything that I knew. And I think I just went into denial. It wasn't happening. It couldn't be happening. It was happening to someone else. Just my own way of dealing with it. Because I generally don't see a lot of women whose cancer comes back. And it generally comes back in the elderly. But you do see young women, and I've looked after them. And I couldn't cope with that image in my head of what I might look like in a few years. So I just kind of blocked it out, which got me through it. But then I was left to deal with those emotions years down the line.
Yeah, and that must have been really difficult for you. I hope you don't mind if we sort of go into that a little bit further.
No.
Okay, thank you. And because I was just sort of, I think it'd be quite helpful for our listeners to sort of just understand a bit more about how perhaps your background had an impact on how you dealt with treatment. I mean, you knew what was going to come up. You've been supporting others through this for years. How did you cope with that?
So the first decision I had to make was where I want to be treated, because my consultant wasn't sure she could. As breast surgeons, you operate on a lot of colleagues because hospitals are mainly full of women and women get breast cancer. And it's really hard operating on someone you know and you work with. The stakes are higher. And she wasn't sure she could do that. And I was suddenly left thinking, well, where do I go? Because I know everyone in my field. And do you choose a centre of excellence like the Christie or the Marsden, for example? Or do you go for the consultant who puts the best pictures up at conferences? Or do you go for the best artist or the best bedside manner? It's really, really hard. And I stuck with her. I wanted to be close to home. It meant I wouldn't have to travel if there were complications, but she had to stop being my friend. And because it was big and I was young, they wanted to give me chemo first to try and shrink it down. I had a mixed ductal and lobular cancer and I had dense breasts, which is why it wasn't seen on the mammogram. And the consultant who met with my husband and I've worked with her as a breast trainee in the hospital. My husband knows her. He was the medical director of the hospital. And she's there telling me all the side effects of chemo. And it was suddenly terrifying being on the receiving end of that consent form saying, well, chemo could cause this or permanent nerve damage in your fingers or this and my fertility. So this it really stuck with me. We'd only been married a couple of years and we hadn't decided whether we wanted to have children. And because the cancer was big, they didn't want to take the risk of giving me treatment to preserve my eggs and harvest them. There was the risk the cancer might grow. And literally in 30 seconds in front of colleagues, my husband and I had to agree that we never have kids. And then we went on to diarrhea and heartburn. And it was that fear of, I give this to my patients, but I'm going to find out what it's like for myself. And that was really, really hard. And I struggled and I was a fit 40-year-old triathlete and I had no idea how the elderly women I prescribe it to. And it suddenly made me realize this isn't smarties. Another really hard bit though was the surgery because I decided to have a nipple sparing reconstruction. I'm really slim. I've got no fat to recreate a breast and I knew I'd need radiotherapy. So if I didn't have an implant, I'd never grow enough of a tummy to have a reconstruction again. And that was a really hard decision to make. And I had 5 months of chemo to make that decision. Most women get 2 or 3 weeks to decide whether they want a reconstruction. And you don't think about your breasts normally. They just sit there in your bra. And when you've got cancer, it's really hard to think about them normally because they've got cancer. You think, how do they define you? Your appearance as a woman, your sexuality. I use my cleavage to flirt. What will I do without it? And I felt guilty that vanity was one of the reasons I wanted a reconstruction because I wore a lot of low-cut V-neck tops at work. And I thought, I don't want to have a wardrobe of turtlenecks. And then I wanted to tell my surgeon what to do. Can you put the scar here and put the drain there? And she says, stop it. Just stop being in control and let me look after you. And that was really hard.
I mean, yeah, everything you're saying is conversations that I've had with a number of women before, but it is so true until you are sort of forced to consider a part of your body in an almost sort of slightly detached way, then it's become slightly separate to you and you're having to make a decision around a very particular part of you. You start to see it very differently.
Exactly. And there's also, I've had patients what their partners think. And I've had patients who are quite happy to go flat, but their partners can't imagine them not having breasts. And I've had a lovely 30-year-old woman who was having chemo who just said, look, take them both off, I don't care. And then a 70-year-old woman who said, what will my granddaughter think when she sees me walking around naked and I only have one breast? And it's not an age thing. And whatever you think is right for you at the time, now I'm quite happy being flat, but I wouldn't have been then. And it's amazing how your situation changes what you think.
Am I to understand then from what you've said that you elected not to have reconstructive surgery in the end?
No, I did. So I did have a reconstruction. Because I'm slim, I didn't have enough tummy fat for a Dieppe reconstruction. And because I'm a triathlete, I didn't want to use my back, my leg or my bum muscles. And I knew I was going to need radiotherapy because the tumor was big and there was a risk that I'd get a really bad capsule with the implant. But there was still a chance to try saving the skin. So I went ahead and had the implant reconstruction.
Thank you for clarifying that. And I mean, we've spoken a bit about how obviously you knowing so much about this beforehand had some real negative impacts. But was there anything that you think, you know, you're very grateful that you did have that knowledge beforehand? It sounds like you were able to have a very educated, informed opinion about what sort of treatment would be right for you.
Yeah, I knew exactly what all my choices were. I knew what all the evidence for and against was. But actually, breast cancer treatment is pretty straightforward. There are so many trials and guidelines. Most people in the UK are offered exactly the same treatment based on their breast size and their tumour size. For me, it was the fear of the unknown. I knew how I would be sore, but I didn't know how sore. With chemo, I knew I'd be tired, but didn't know how tired I would be. And I realized everything I knew as a breast surgeon was irrelevant because I was now a breast cancer patient. And although I knew the side effects of the tamoxifen, I had no idea how to deal with them. And I realized there were so many things we could be doing to improve the lives of our patients that had never crossed my mind. But the big thing for me was, so after chemo and my surgery, the chemo showed in scans that my tumor had disappeared completely. So I was expecting good news. Yes, this has worked. And we often give chemo up front to shrink a tumor so women can avoid a mastectomy. But I still had one because I've got tiny breasts. And actually, there was still 13 centimeters of lobular cancer in my breast that hadn't been seen on the MRI. Doctors always have weird things. And it had spread to three of my lymph nodes. And it was the 23rd of December. And at that moment, I knew, because it was bigger and my lymph nodes were involved, I was even less likely to be around in 10 years' time. And that took me a really, really long time to deal with. That knowledge that, what do you do? The worrying, is this the day it comes back? And I had no idea how hard it was. I used to glibly see patients in clinic and they'd come in with a cough and I said, no, it's fine, don't worry, off you go. But when you are that patient worried, that really, really hit me.
Of course. And I mean, this is going to be a huge question, but, and you've just sort of scratched the surface of it, but how has life changed since that initial diagnosis?
So I had 9 months of treatment, so chemo, surgery, radiotherapy, and I took another 6 months off because my brain didn't work anymore. With chemo and the menopause, I couldn't think, I couldn't multitask, and I wasn't sure whether I could cope with being a breast cancer surgeon having had breast cancer. And I also didn't realize that after a cancer diagnosis, you are legally disabled, and that means that your employer has to allow reasonable adjustments to let you come back to work. And my own line manager at the time didn't know it. They wanted to give me a month to go back to work. And I said, hang on, I've had my own cancer, I've had a year off. And we managed to negotiate 6 months of part-time work shadowing consultants at another hospital. They didn't know me, so they could be honest and actually say, could I cut it? Could I tell someone they had cancer? Could I operate? And oh my God, that was hard. The first time I saw someone being told they had breast cancer, I saw myself. I saw them clutching their partner's hand, swallowing, looking at the floor, wiping their tears, thinking, right. And I was right back there. And I wanted to say, yes, this is shit. This is awful, but we will get you through this. And the consultants are saying, no, it's good. It's just a little bit of cancer. They'll be fine. They think, but you don't understand what the word cancer means. And it was really hard operating because I got post-mastectomy pain syndrome that happens to about 15 to 20% of women. And I had it really badly, especially with the radiotherapy. And I thought, I can't cut these women because they might hurt and I'll be responsible. And it took a long time to be able to distance myself and realize I still have to be the bad guy, the one that has to break bad news. I can't share your story. Because you'll know this. And one thing that's very common is whenever you tell someone bad news, they want to join in that conversation. They say, oh, I had that. Oh, my aunt had that. And you just don't give a shit because you're going through it yourself. And I wanted to connect because I didn't meet another breast cancer patient in the flesh throughout my treatment. So to have women in front of me who knew what I'd been through, it's really, really hard. I did go back to work. And one of the things that I started doing was when I saw women at their 1 year follow-up, I started asking about menopause and their sex life, because that was one of the biggest killers for me. That the vaginal dryness, the pain, the loss of libido. I never talked to patients about it. I didn't know how it happened. It was amazing people like Sam Talk Sex on Twitter who I reached out to who said, this is how you can help. And I used to, it was kind of a judgment call, but I'd see women and say, now, are you having trouble with your sex life? I know tamoxifen can do this. And then I'd say, actually, I've been there, I can help. Because I thought they were a year down the line and no one knows whether I should or should have done it. But just sometimes seeing the look on women's faces of relief, thinking, oh my God, there's help. So, and I'd been back at work for about 4 or 5 months and I was planning to go flat. Radiotherapy, as you know, can cause an implant to get really quite hard and painful. I had really bad pain. I thought, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to go flat. But I'd had a nodule of scar tissue in my armpit that I'd been having physio on. And my surgeon said, let's just get a scan just to make sure it's nothing. And it ended up being a 2.5 centimeter local recurrence on my chest wall. And I'm a consultant breast surgeon. And I didn't realize my cancer was there the first time. And I didn't realize it was there the second time. So it's really hard for patients. And that meant going flat. It meant more radiotherapy. it meant chronic pain and permanent reduced function of my left arm, and it meant I can no longer operate. So I retired in 2019. So it's crazy that the one illness I spent my life training to treat actually stopped me doing my job. But my life has changed completely, and I now help far more people through talking and writing and podcasting than I ever could as a surgeon. And it's amazing to reach out to patients and actually help them. And I think the medical profession listened to me because I've been on both sides. I know it's very hard as patient advocates to get in front of a medical audience and make them hear you, but I hope I can use my platform to do that. But my life isn't what I thought it would be 5-6 years ago.
I imagine that's probably quite an understatement. There's sort of, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time? And then there's, you know, where could you never have pictured yourself?
I know. They're
two very different things. But I mean, it's very important at these times to sort of talk about things that maybe we wouldn't have talked about before.
Yeah.
And I think just the fact that you were able to, while you were still in your role, bring up things that people might not have spoken about, that especially things that surgeons might not have thought were as pertinent to mention. I know so many people come out the other side of treatment and then they're suddenly hit with a wave of things they didn't know that they were supposed to expect, and they don't know where to go next.
The medical profession often thinks, well, you should be grateful. Your scar looks pretty. We've taken the cancer out. Off you go. Go and live. And you think, well, we've got all the side effects of all these treatments. We're just meant to put up with and be grateful to be alive. And it's not enough.
Yeah, quite simply put, I think you're totally right. And as you sort of mentioned just a moment ago, since 2019, your life has been very different.
Yeah.
What sort of things are you doing now then? How are you using both sides of your experience to inform what you do with your day-to-day at the moment?
So the first thing I did was to start writing. I kept a blog during treatment, mainly because my mum had just moved to Scotland and my brother lived in Switzerland. So it was a way of keeping them up to date. But I realised I could educate people as to what it's actually like. A lot of us, when we write blogs, we can be really emotional, or we kind of, all the drama's in there. But I wanted it just to be something like a safe, sensible opinion for people to understand. And I started going on forums, and I was really scared and frightened by the questions women were asking. And it's like, don't they listen to what we say? Oh, no, they don't. Because I now know you're just thinking, oh my God, I've got cancer. I need a mastectomy. Women asking, is it safe to have sex during chemo? Because will my husband's hair fall out? Or does radiotherapy make you radioactive? And I got in touch with a couple of doctors on social media who had breast cancer. And Trish Greenhalgh and I thought, we need to write a book. We need to help people understand what is happening to them, and how to interpret what the doctor is telling you and how to live afterwards. And that's led to me talking all over the world and starting a podcast and doing videos just to help educate women about what's normal, what's sensible, what's safe. And I get 3 or 4 emails every day and feedback just saying thank you. And that gives me joy, because all I want to do is help people. And I didn't want to waste all that information I had. So although I'm retired, I spend a lot of my time putting content out there. But it's so nice to have time to have a life again. Because as a surgeon, I was the most boring dinner party guest. I'd spent 20 years of my life working, eating, sleeping, doing exams, doing on-call, doing night shifts. And suddenly, I can go to the gym regularly. I can ride my bike. I can garden. I volunteer at a hedgehog shelter. I've suddenly become a much more rounded person and realized I don't need that salary to live on. What's important to me is spending time with family and friends. And cancer is never a gift. It's never something you want. But it made me take a long, hard look at my life and realize it's time to put me first and be a bit selfish and actually get some joy back again.
I'm really happy to hear that. And the hedgehog shelter sounds fantastic.
Oh, I love it. I clean out hedgehogs. There's a couple in their 70s who look after rescue hedgehogs. And once a week, I spend a couple of hours cleaning up their poo and their pee. I also get to hold baby hedgehogs. So there's a little bit in it for me. But it's just that, it's that sense of giving back. Like so many people, you know, they raise money by doing crazy exercise things just to give something back. And it's just my way of doing it and just saying thank you.
Oh, that all sounds very wholesome and wonderful and lovely. And I'm glad to hear that you're doing things that are, you know, making you feel fulfilled.
Yeah.
And you are still using all that knowledge and experience. And, you know, those 20 years, like, definitely informed where you are today.
And who'd have thought I'd be talking about my sex life in the Mail on Sunday and doing Instagram lives talking about sex and breast cancer. It's like, that was not me. I was the most introverted private person in the world.
Yeah, what a shift.
I think it's really important to say, I sound like I'm superwoman. I still have bad days. I still worry about it coming back. Whenever someone dies in the media or a friend, I get guilty that they're dead and I'm not. I think the mental side of dealing with breast cancer, and it's why I've got a WhatsApp group for doctors with cancer who I can tell the crazy things in my head. A friend once told me, he's no longer with us, that he was glad the day his melanoma came back because he could stop waiting for it to happen and start dealing with it. Mm. Now, nobody wants their cancer to come back, but it's that fear of living and waiting. And I think it's really important to use forums or support groups to be able to have those honest conversations with people who get it, because your family won't. And that took me a long time to say, okay, I can't talk about that with my husband. He doesn't need to know it, but I need to get this off my chest. And it's really important to acknowledge that you will wobble. There are weeks when I'll just stay off social media because I'm not in a strong enough place to deal with it. And I think that's really important. When you do become a patient advocate, it's important to realize that you don't actually owe anybody anything, and you can step back and protect your own mental health, because it is hard being in the cancer world all the while. Mm.
I'm really glad you touched on that, actually, because one of the last things I was going to ask you was, you know, is there anything that you still turn to look after your mental and physical health? And I think you've already mentioned some fantastic things there. I think one of the huge things there is staying off social media, because again, with the before you're too certain about diagnosis, turning to Google or whatever, not as reliable sources for those answers. Turning to social media at any point can be very stressful, but if you're already in a bad place and you then find yourself in that inescapable echo chamber of lots of people sort of turning to that to express those worries and those negative thoughts, I know it can be very dangerous, but is there anything else that you would particularly recommend to others, that saying if they're in a bad place, how are they looking after themselves? What would you recommend?
Well, I think the first thing to say is to know what's going to set you off. And for a lot of us, it's fear of recurrence. And most doctors and nurses, we're not very good at telling you what the signs and symptoms are, because when is the right time? You've just been diagnosed. Oh, it might come back in 2 years' time, or it's the end of year. It's really hard to tell people. Say the breast cancer on our website, go and have a look and find out what things you need to be worried about are. And if there is something you're worried about, make a note in your diary. And 2 weeks later, if it's still there and you can't explain it, and it's either a cough that won't go away, or you've got tummy pain or a headache, or you've got bone pain at night, talk to your GP, because your GP is the person who can get you into the breast clinic again. And if you just say you can't get an appointment, just ring up the secretary and say, I've had breast cancer, I've got a cough, I'm worried it's come back. They will send you into the clinic to get it looked at. It's terrifying when they send you in, because you think, oh my God, they think it could be serious. I don't want women worrying at home for months and months and weeks and weeks. If you've had it for a couple of weeks, see the GP, get it sorted out. So that knowledge can empower you. I think it's really, really important. For me, for my mental health, it's knowing the physical signs of depression or anxiety, because I'll often recognize those before my brain realizes what's going on. Often your sleep is disrupted. You're sleeping too much, or you can't get to sleep. You're off your food, you're eating too much. You feel jittery. You just can't be bothered to read a book, or you don't want to watch your favorite thing on Netflix. For me, it's realizing. So I got very depressed just after Christmas. And it was like, I'm not sleeping. I need a break. I need to step back. And I think being in tune with your physical warning signs is really, really important. The best thing for me is getting out in nature, just going for a dog walk, listening to the birds in the garden, just not thinking about anything. And for me, I deleted Twitter and Instagram for 2 weeks. I didn't need that in my life. I didn't need to know what was going on. You realize how many hours a day we all spend scrolling. And it's just that, let's just reset and work out what's important to me. It's important to know that the mental depression, anxiety, almost post-traumatic stress can come on months or even years after breast cancer diagnosis. Every time I walk down the corridor to the screening mammogram, I'm back there again. And it's kind of saying, I'm going to wobble today, tell people, cancel anything important, and just give yourself that breathing space to get through it.
Thank you. And genuinely thank you, because I know, as you said, you have had a difficult time recently, and yet you are still here talking to us and giving fantastic advice. And I'm really pleased to hear as well that you're sort of supporting the resources that breast cancer now have as well. That's, yeah, I think, something that we really want to provide through our services, information that people can turn to that's reliable. And I think what you mentioned about looking out for signs and symptoms of secondary, of recurrence, those are things that we have on our site that we want to make accessible for everyone. If anyone's listening to this and they want to go and check those out quickly, I'm sure we'll link them in the episode description. But yeah, thank you again for being so open and honest about your experiences and for reminding people that this isn't something that once you've got through the surgery, once you've got through chemo or radio, that you're just done with it. This is something that's ongoing. And I think it's important that we talk about that.
It is. And I think, so a lot of women don't realise their breast cancer can come back, and it can. And it generally comes back in the first couple of years, or it comes back 5, 10, 20 years down the line. And that's why we follow women up for 5 years with screening mammograms just to check everything's okay. But you do need to be vigilant afterwards. And I worried, I fretted, I was obsessed with what my percentage chance of being alive in 10 years was. And I was definitely cut puff empty. That's it. And time is a great healer, but now I think it's actually 50-50. It comes back or it doesn't. It's out of my control. Well, actually, that's not true. We know that exercising, doing aerobic and weight-bearing exercise, can halve the risk of recurrence compared to, which is much, much more than the benefits you get from chemotherapy or tamoxifen. So I think if I can exercise regularly and keep my weight healthy, because we know being overweight can increase the risk of recurrence. And why is that? Well, it's all because of estrogen. This is for women with estrogen positive cancer. You make estrogen in your fat after the menopause. So when you stop your tamoxifen, the more fat you have, the more estrogen you will make. So as hard as it is, if you eat healthy and exercise, you can reduce your risk of recurrence by up to 50%. And I now just try and live my life normally. And I've almost forgotten I've had it. But I wouldn't have said that 3 years ago. I would have still been in the, oh my goodness, is that a cough? And it's just, it takes time. But you do need to constantly just check in with yourself for any weird signs and symptoms. Because it, as I said, it can come back 10, 20 years down the line.
Yeah, absolutely.
And breast cancer now, the website is fantastic. But I would say send your family, your loved ones to it. Get them to go and read it. You don't need to be the one telling them. Get them to go and read it. If you want to explain to your partner why you are a crazy menopausal woman, send them to the bit about tamoxifen and what it does, so they realize it's not your fault. This is happening. It's part of treatment. It's like podcasts or books. It's a great way of helping people understand what is happening to you without you having to be a patient and a doctor.
Absolutely. And I mean, your expertise and your straightforwardness about these things is just completely invaluable. And you have mentioned that you've got your own podcast, and I think now would be an opportune moment to send people towards that if they did definitely want to hear more of what you've got to say, because I think you could really, you know, if we reach a few more people with this, it would be so helpful. So where can they find you?
Oh, thanks, Em. So I started a podcast last October called Don't Ignore the Elephant on all podcast screening platforms. And because I'm known for talking about my sex life and death in public, I just thought, let's talk about the stuff that people don't talk about. And my first guest was the amazing Greg Wise, who half the people I speak to don't know. He's Emma Thompson's husband. I was obsessed with him in Sense and Sensibility back in the 80s and 90s. But he looked after his sister, Claire, who died of metastatic breast cancer. He moved in with her for 6 months and she blogged about it, which he then took over. And he thinks we all need to start talking about death and dying, because it's the one thing that's going to happen to us. And it's just a beautiful message to hear what it was like for him to look after someone. And then I speak to the amazing Catherine Mannix, who's a palliative care consultant, who just talks about what happens. Because I was scared of dying, because as a doctor, I've seen the uncomfortable deaths in hospital where people suddenly have heart attacks or their surgery goes wrong. But most people die really peacefully. And just listening to her explain what happens and what to expect just made me feel at peace. But we talk about sex and cancer and sexual grief and anxiety and depression and just all the stuff that no one talks about, but we all experience. And I've had a lot of women who listened to the sex episode with Samantha Evans, who then got their husbands to listen to it as a starting point to start talking about why they don't want sex and how they can get things back on track. And it's been so nice to hear people who found it useful. So yeah, Don't Ignore the Elephant.
What a brilliant name. I really like that.
We've all got elephants in the room, haven't we?
Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
I guess I should probably just mention the book that I wrote, The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer.
Please do. Yes. Yeah.
So when I was diagnosed, I bought 10 books about breast cancer written by patients because I wanted to know what it would be like. And Professor Trish Greenhouse, she's an amazing woman who's actually been behind a lot of the COVID mask evidence. She bought another 10 books because as though we were both expert doctors, we had no idea what it was like. What do you eat? What do you do? And this is a book of all the questions we wanted to know about how to go through treatment, how to cope with it afterwards, and what happens at the end. And I've had doctors and oncologists recommend it to patients to say, look, just read this and it will guide you through. And I'd hate to promote my own book, but I just think it's a really, really good resource to help women and their families understand what's happening.
Yeah, no, please do promote away. Like, as you say, it's the more resources, the better. And even no matter how much expertise you have, you can always have more.
Because Trish and I have both had breast cancer and we have had every single treatment between us. We know what it's like and we know how to help you.
Well, fantastic. Thank you. And if people want to find you on social media, where can they do that?
Thanks, Em. So on Instagram, I'm at @OReardonLiz, where I post a lot of videos about how to examine your breasts and how to fit a bra properly. And then I'm also on Twitter as @Liz_OReardon. And I will answer any message from anybody. So please get in touch if you have a question.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And we will link those in the show notes for anyone who wants to quickly click through. And I mean, all that's left to say is, Liz, thank you so much. Genuinely, this has been a great start to our new season of Breast Cancer Now podcast. And it's been fascinating to talk to you. And I really hope that people will check out more of your work because I think they'll find it just so, so helpful. So, yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's been brilliant to chat.
If you've enjoyed listening to this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe via your preferred podcast provider so that you never miss an episode. Also, if you're able to, we'd love it if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend us to someone you think would find us helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them.